But when we planned this convention, or actually, like, a few weeks after I was nominated as chairperson for this convention, before I had a committee, before I had a place to meet, I knew who I wanted my Saturday night speaker to be. And so it was probably a year and a half ago that with very shaky fingers, I dialed this number, and I called Arbutus. And she said, "When is it going to be?" And I said, "August 2000. She said, "Honey, do you know how old I am?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am." But they told me if I wanted to get you, I had to get you way ahead of time. And so we made tentative plans. And I kept praying that Arbutus would... I want you to stay well all the time, but I really wanted you to stay well till now. But as I was trying to say before, when it wasn't my turn, the first time I ever heard of Arbutus was through my husband's AA sponsor. And so every time I thought of Arbutus, I had this like little band of angels singing behind her in my mind. But I grew in the program a little bit more and realized that we're all human and there's no perfect people and that nobody really has a band of angels following them around singing Arbutus. Okay, I promise y'all I'm going to get out of here and let her speak. And she's the only person I enjoy turning this microphone over to, Arbutus.
This is the craziest bunch of people I ever met. Except in Oklahoma. They're a little wild in Oklahoma, too. My name is Arbutus O'Neill, and it is for the grace of God that I belong to the All-Known Family Groups. I am powerless over people, places, and things. And because of this program, I can make this admission without feeling guilty. My life continues to be unmanageable when I fail to practice the principles that were given to us by a bunch of ex-drunks who found sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like to believe that the families of the early members of AA were convinced by the miracle of sobriety that this program would work for everyone. And it was out of this conviction that the All-Known Family Groups grew to reach all over the world and have shown astounding results. We subscribe to the concept that alcoholism is a family illness. And then we get so carried away telling people how sick we got that we forget to say, we have a program for family recovery. And that's what this weekend's all about. I just love your slogan, celebration of gratitude. That's what this weekend's all about. We'll listen to the speakers and participate in the workshops and support the ALA team members. And we'll see whole families getting well while they're having a wonderful time. A showcase of recovery. And I'm very grateful to be a part of it. I feel a little strange when you start this countdown business. I sometimes think I'm older than God. And I keep you updated. I was 84 the 25th of June, so. And I like to believe that families of the early members, when all of this thing started, we developed the concept that alcoholism is a family illness, and then we got so carried away that we forget to remind you of the recovery part. And that's why these weekends are so very important. And the AA people, and they're delightful. They come to these conferences and they're always so glad to see each other. They charge across the room and beat each other on the back, and Chuck Chamberlain said, "Everybody's talking, nobody's listening." And then somebody else will come through that door back there and they stop right in the middle of a sentence and they'll say, look, there's old George. And he's still sober. They don't even expect each other to stay sober. love without expectancy, we call it. They call me a long-timer in the all-nun family groups. They don't have the nerve enough to call me an old-timer. And this isn't very important until you get to be a long-timer. And I'll tell you how to do it. You just keep coming to meetings and try to stay alive, and you'll make it. One of our friends out in Midland says, don't drink and don't die. And I once thought that alcoholism was a product of my generation, but this isn't true. Alcoholism is as old as time. Alcoholism is an insidious, progressive illness that prompts the unthinking to make jokes about drunks, but it can leave a family homeless and penniless. Alcoholism is a public cancer that can turn a man or a woman against themselves. Alcoholism is a blight on the history of mankind. The Bible warns against it. Shakespeare diagnosed it. Tennessee Williams built a prize-winning play around it. But no one, as far as I've been able to learn, seemed to do much about alcoholism until the advent of AA. Priests and ministers were baffled at their inability to cope with this insidious habit, this dreadful malady, if you please. They preached to alcoholics, prayed over you, had you sign pledges. And when these things failed, they damned your soul to hell. Men of science in other generations wanted to find a cure for alcoholism. They wanted to find a pill or a vaccine that would stop compulsive drinking. And failing to do this, they said to the medical students, don't waste your time on these people. They're hopeless. Preachment failed, and there was no cure. So there was one other thing they knew to do with alcoholics. You must be punished. So we locked you up in jail. The more you drank, the longer we kept you in jail. The longer we kept you in jail, the drunker you got when we released you. It became a vicious cycle. We tried to change the body chemistry of sick people with punishment. And society allowed this to happen. Nay, we insisted on it to our everlasting shame. I'm quite sure that we'll never know how many sick alcoholics died in the jails around our country at the hands of sadistic jailers. We'll never know. But there was one group of people who never gave up on the alcoholic. These were the families of alcoholics, the people who loved you. We took jobs to feed the children that you were too sick to be responsible for. We doctored your hangovers. Some of us bought your liquor. We picked up your hot checks, bailed you out of jails. We pled with judges. We said, John's a good man when he's sober. And to complete this ridiculous paradox, we gave you hell every time you got drunk. And society could not understand the families of alcoholics. They could understand the alcoholic when you all walked off your jobs and wrecked your cars and wore lampshades on your head at parties. They could understand that because you had been drinking. But they couldn't understand us. They couldn't understand why we continued to love and care for the alcoholic. Some people, of course, thought we were endowed with some special quality that made us better than other people. They were the ones that gave us the halos. I put mine on every morning. When I put on my lipstick. And my halo had a name. My halo was called self-righteousness. Did you ever notice that word don't taste good? Self-righteousness. We don't wear those halos anymore. You can find them discarded in any Al-Anon meeting you want to attend, and you're most welcome, you know, of course. We don't need halos anymore, and I'd like you to know we did not find them very comfortable. Other people, of course, thought we were plain fools to live under such circumstances. My mother came in this group. Mother used to say, God looks after fools and drunks, and that takes care of our abuse and bill. And Mother was right. God did look after us when we didn't have sense enough to look after ourselves. And then a little time went by, and the professionals got interested in the families of alcoholics. And they were the ones that put the labels on us. And you know what they were. Aggravating influences, we were called. Disturbing factors. And then they took the wraps off and they called her Suffering Susies. Wavering Winifreds. Couldn't find anything to rhyme with Arbutus. And I got a little weary of all these surveys and research projects. I was involved with one when Marty Mann was still around, and this woman was spending government money and a waste of time trying to find out what kind of women marry alcoholics. And Marty suggested that I go across the hall and help her with her project, and she found out what kind of women marry alcoholics. Old women, young women, fat women, skinny women. But the truth of the matter, women do not marry alcoholics. They marry the men they love, and some of them have alcoholism. But I've never known anybody just to deliberately go out and find an alcoholic. So the professionals got interested in us, and a little more time went by, and it got to be the kind of the end thing to have an alcoholic in your family. Now, if you don't have one, well, I strongly suspect that you get one. Don't marry them, just borrow one. They're the handiest things you can have. They're as handy as a pocket on a shirt. Anything at all that goes wrong, it's their fault. Back in the 40s, they were writing all magazines and newspapers. It's almost impossible anymore to pick up a magazine or a newspaper and not find an article on alcoholism. I was absolutely flabbergasted a few years ago to find an article on alcoholism in the Atlantic Monthly. You know, that's a pretty prestigious publication. They're a little careful about what they publish, but there it was, big as life and twice as natural, an article on alcoholism. And so I decided I'd start me a little research project of my own. And I learned that Alexander the Great was an alcoholic. He'd conquered the whole known civilized world when he was 33 years old. And he wept because there were no more worlds to conquer. But he couldn't conquer his desire to drinking, and he died prematurely in an alcoholic convulsion. Now, for a long time, I always took a great deal of time to explain to you why I did this little history lesson, as my group calls it. And I explained to you that I did that because I couldn't tell jokes. I always forget the punchline. But a couple of years ago, I was up in Illinois, and a pretty little lady came to the airport to meet me when I came in for that conference. She had asked permission of the Al-Anon committee. She said, I want to meet Arbutus at the airport because I want to talk to her. And so what she wanted to talk to me about, she said when her drinking became critical, she just could not, she absolutely could not admit that she was an alcoholic. She'd never been kicked out of school, wrecked her car, been in jail. There's no way that she could be an alcoholic. And she went to a few AA meetings, and she didn't want to be associated with that kind of people. There was just no way that she could admit this. And then she heard one of those dastardly tapes, and she heard me say that Alexander the Great was an alcoholic, and she thought that was pretty good company, and she hasn't had a drink since. So I'm glad I told the story about Alexander the Great. No, I tell you these things to point out something that I think is very significant. The very self-same people who, before our generations, were so baffled at their inability to do anything about alcoholism are doing a great deal about it right now. When drinking became critical in mine and Bill's life, there was no such thing as a treatment center. You couldn't get an alcoholic in the hospital unless the doctor was willing to falsify his diagnosis and say that Bill had the flu. Bill liked to die of the flu.
But now you can get an alcoholic in the hospital with a simple diagnosis of alcoholism. Priests and ministers now feel that alcoholics are God's children too, and so they send them to AA meetings so they can get well, and they send their families to us so they can get well too. County judges now send alcoholics to treatment centers instead of sending them to jail. And we have fabulous programs in our federal penitentiaries under the auspices of AA. They're doing a great deal about alcoholism right now. But I wonder if you've noticed something. With all of their training and their good intentions, they're not getting the job done. They're just not getting the job done. But right now, this very minute, I'm looking at a room full of experts. You're the people who know about alcoholism. You know about alcoholism because you've lived with it. You know the symptoms, the progression. You know about slips in AA. You know about the alibi system. There isn't very much about alcoholism that you do not know because you've lived with it. So in my opinion, this is a job for you to do. A job for you and for me. And I learned this a long time ago. You see, when I came in this outfit before we had an outfit. I really did. We had 50 Al-Anon groups in the world when I came here. 50 groups. I went up to the Royal Service Office when I was in Richmond a couple of months ago, and they told me there that we have 30,000 Al-Anon groups in the world now. And I've seen this fellowship evolve from 50 groups to 30,000 groups. And it's been the most fascinating thing in my life. Wouldn't take $1 million for it. Wouldn't do it again for another million. And when I came here, we didn't have any literature. We didn't have a program to live by. But worse than that, we didn't have a purpose to live for. All we had in those very early days was the growing awareness of need for help and the very dubious permission of some people who were very new in AA to come to their meeting places while they had a meeting. And that's what we did. We met in wide hallways and dirty little kitchens around the country, anywhere we could put a few chairs. And we sat together and we talked. Now you know very well what we talked about. It was kind of a morbid competition to determine which one of us lived with the sorriest man. And I wasn't comfortable in those meetings because I didn't live with a sorry man. I lived with a fine young man who drank too much. Al-Anon, as you well know, is a kissing cousin to invention. They were both born of necessity. And these dear people who put the life-changing program of Alcoholics Anonymous together knew, they were visionaries, they knew that in time the families of alcoholics would become aware of this necessity. And so when they wrote the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, they made provisions for us because they included in that book two chapters for the families of alcoholics. One of the chapters, as you well know, is entitled Two Wives. Now, that is not intended to be a put-down to people like Bo and other men who are members of the Al-Anon family group. Not at all. The fact of the matter is that when that book was written, there were no women in AA. So they entitled that chapter Two Wives. The groups in Canada called their groups wives groups. And the other chapter is to the family afterwards. And down in my part of the country where I grew up in Al-Anon, we took a paragraph out of that chapter and made a preamble that we used to open our meetings. And this is what the paragraph says. The past is the principal asset of the alcoholic's family, and frequently it is almost the only one. This painful past can be of infinite value to families still struggling with their problem. We feel that each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not, and when the occasion requires, each member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others how we were given help is the only thing that makes our life worthwhile. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, your dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death or misery for them. I don't know how you all feel about that, but to me, that's heavy stuff. That is heavy stuff. Now, there's a rumor going around in some parts of the country that under no circumstances should an Al-Anon member read the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it's banned in Boston. This is the silliest thing that I ever heard of in my life. The book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is the world's foremost authority on alcoholism. And when I came here, I found myself in the big middle of the state of Texas with four children under the age of five, 1,700 miles from my home, alienated from my family, and Bill's family would not accept me. I felt if Bill got back to Texas with his own family that they would understand that Bill had a problem and I'd have a backup group. It didn't work that way. They readily understand why Bill drank so much. He was married to that Yankee from North Carolina where they make all that bourbon liquor. I didn't have a backup group. But I was beautifully blessed, because I was exposed to the spiritual giants in this program. And I went to these people in AA, and I told them I was scared to death. And I said, I just cannot understand Bill. I can't understand him. Bill hates a liar, but he can't tell the truth. And he's irresponsible. I can't depend on him. I don't know if he's coming home, when he's coming home, or if he's coming home. I just don't understand. Now, this may not be verbatim, and please remember, anything I tell you may or may not be the truth. But it is my perception of the truth, and that's all I have to offer you. And so these people said to me, read this book. Read this book, Arbutus. It will explain the nature of the illness that Bill has. And they went on to say, and it will teach you the philosophy that you need for your recovery. And that's what I wanted. I believe in books. If it's printed in a book, I believe it. And if you forget what it said, you can go read it again. I believe in books. And so that's exactly what I did. I studied that book. Now, people quote me once in a while, and that's a very fine compliment. But please quote me correctly. I have never said that I expect every Al-Anon family group member in the world to own and read the big book. I never have. Never will. What I do say is that I require the people that I sponsor to study the first 164 pages of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, or get themselves another sponsor. No problem. The truth of the matter is that when we developed the Al-Anon family group literature, we developed it as a supplement, with the assumption, which is always a mistake, that you had first studied that 164 pages of the big book. Actually, Al-Anon literature doesn't make very much sense if you don't have that background. We expect you to study the 164 pages and use the Al-Anon literature as a supplement. And it somehow got out of hand. But if you have problems in your district about studying the big book, come on over to West Texas. You'll find it over there. I believe if I went home Thursday night and I went to my meeting and everybody had a big book in their lap, I'd feel very uncomfortable. But I also know that, and I quote Lois Wilson in saying this, that without the big book, we wouldn't have a fellowship. We don't have a program, you know. Never did have a program, and we never will. We use the AA program with their permission. And don't forget that. With their permission. I wonder sometimes why they don't close the door on us. But this thing of the controversy with the big book is just kind of silly as far as I'm concerned. My Bill used to say, I can't understand these people. They raise families and run businesses and take care of drunks, but they can't run their own Al-Anon group. So it didn't make sense. I attended my first open AA meeting in Amarillo, Texas in 1948. I didn't want to go to that meeting. If you haven't picked up on the accent before, I'll tell you I'm a hillbilly. I grew up in the hills of North Carolina. Bill said he brought me out of the hills and put shoes on me. But hillbillies don't like to be obliged. And the only reason that I went to that meeting is because I'd put myself under an obligation to a very beautiful woman who was married to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I say, it was an open meeting. There was about 150 people there. And I drank a lot of coffee, you notice. And I'm quite sure that I'd made several trips to the coffee bar when the meeting started. And a beautiful woman that I later learned was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous leaned across Marguerite and whispered to me. And what she said was, "How long's it been since you had a drink, honey?" And I wasn't embarrassed by her question. I'm not a teetotaler. I used to say I didn't trust teetotalers, but I have a friend down in Wichita Falls, Texas, that's never even tasted liquor. She's a real teetotaler. And I'd trust Mildred with my life, so I don't say that anymore. But Marguerite was terribly embarrassed, and she answered the lady's question for me. She said, "Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic." Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. I grew up in a house with two men, both of whom was my father. My dad was a two-fisted construction man who worked hard, he played hard, and he drank hard. Dad was a gray-eyed Irishman who taught me to love poetry. He taught me to sing Irish folk songs. He had the patience to teach me to work my geometry problems with his framing square. But on Saturday night, my dad turned into a devil. My father's alcoholism destroyed both of my parents. My father's alcoholism turned my beautiful mother into an old, ugly, bitter woman who hated him. She hated him as long as she lived. She hated him long after he was dead and in his grave. And the last years of her life, which she spent in total darkness, she hated anybody that had ever loved John Martin. And that included me. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. Now, I do not tell you these things about my dad or about my mother that you may weep for them. I tell you these things about my dad and about my mother that you may know that I've always loved an alcoholic. And because I love alcoholics, I want to restore their families. Because I know with all my heart that of all the things an alcoholic loves, you love your families most. Of this I'm convinced. You love your families most. Even when you tear us down over and over and over again, you love your families most. And I wasn't concerned with Bill's drinking when we were married. Father Martin says the only way you can tell an alcoholic is by the one that you know. And Bill was not a hallucinating drunk like my father. My father saw creeping, crawling things, and he hurt my mother. He hurt her physically, and he hurt her emotionally. Mother never could understand when her jaw was broken that Dad had simply meant to kill a centipede that was crawling in her hair. She couldn't understand that, and I'm quite sure I couldn't either. But Bill was not a hallucinating drunk. Bill was a life-of-the-party drunk. He crashed debutante's parties and taught them to put your little foot. Bill had fun with his drinking. And it was important in my generation that we have fun. And a lady told me one time that she had so much fun, it liked to kill her. And that's about what happened to Bill and me. But in 1940, two things happened that should have made Bill and me grow up. We became parents, and the world became involved in a war. And I quit drinking with Bill. Things were too serious. I was watching the troop movements in Europe and later in the South Pacific. My two brothers were in the military. Bill had family members in the military. I was watching the casualty list. I quit drinking with Bill. We had our second child the next year, and Bill was not there when Nancy was born. Nancy came on Wednesday, but she didn't meet her dad till next Sunday. My friends in AA tell me there is no loneliness in the world as great as that of the alcoholic who has run out of time. And I believe they believe this. But I also believe that I know about loneliness. The loneliness of an alcoholic's wife when she goes to a delivery room with the full knowledge that a compulsion to drink is depriving her of her husband's devotion. This, I believe, is loneliness. The lonely task of keeping the spirit of Christmas alive for small children whose father has forgotten what day it is. This, I believe, is loneliness. And the crawling fingers of loneliness that you feel when you wait by the hospital bed of an injured child who cries for her dad. And you can't find her dad. I want my daddy. And you can't find her dad. This, I believe, is loneliness. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. Our only son was born the next year. Now, please don't get excited. There's not that many of them. Our only son came the next year, and I couldn't talk about this for a long time because the guilt I felt. We had two little girls, and Bill wanted a little boy. I guess all of you men want a son. And I manipulated that pregnancy. And when Luther was born, something went wrong in the delivery room, and they needed Bill. And they couldn't find Bill. Now, had I been able to talk to them, I could have told them that they'd find Bill in a bar. But you see, I didn't know which one. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. They told us that our little boy would never walk. And again, I was absolutely and totally overwhelmed with guilt. And I started a trek that encompassed the whole of these United States, trying to find a doctor that would make my boy walk. Fortunately for Teresa, bless her heart, she was one of those beautifully healthy babies that thrived on loving neglect, and that's all she got. Because I took Luther from one crippled children's hospital to the next, trying to find a doctor that would make my boy walk. I didn't pray for Luther to walk. I didn't have anything to pray to. And when I came into this fellowship, I said I had no faith, but I really did. I had faith in medical doctors, and I was determined that I would find a doctor that would make my boy walk. I sometimes forget to tell people that Luther learned to walk. Bless his heart, he didn't learn to walk until he was 3 years old. But when he weighed into the Navy, when he was not quite 18 years old, he weighed in at 189 pounds. And when I saw him run across the parking lot or jump a fence, as long as he lived, I always got a in my throat because he wasn't supposed to walk. The drinking progressed, of course, as it always does, and Bill started having personality clashes with the people he worked for, and he changed jobs pretty often. And one of these jobs took us down to Knoxville, Tennessee, about the time they brought that atomic energy plant into that little sleepy southern town, and it turned into a madhouse. Thousands of people came in there. Bill had a good job. He was office manager for Holland Furnace Company. He had a good salary, and he also made a commission on every furnace that he sold, and he wasn't one bit reluctant to take a little money under the table if you need the furnace real bad. He had a good job. And we were evicted from a furnished rent house in Knoxville, Tennessee, that ranged for $50 a month for non-payment of rent. And I saw the look of pity and disgust on the faces of those who served them. And we couldn't find a house in Knoxville. So we had to move up into Kentucky, 70 miles away, and finally found a garage apartment. And I was expecting our fourth child any minute. And I checked in with the hospital to learn that I was not eligible to go there to be delivered of my child because that hospital was for the exclusive use of the coal mining people who lived in that area, and I wasn't eligible to go there to be delivered of my baby. And while I was contemplating the possibility of having to get a midwife to deliver my child, they carried Bill home. Now, they'd carried Bill home before, but this time his leg was broken. And they did put a cast on Bill's leg at the emergency room. And we started that dismal, miserable trek going home to Mother, who lived in Cincinnati, Ohio. Now get the picture. Peggy was 3 years old. Nancy was two. Luther was not quite one year old and couldn't walk. And I was expecting another baby. My stomach looked like a watermelon that you just cut one slice off of. So we go home. And I don't know, when we got on the bus and went to Cincinnati, and to this day, I do not know who was the most relieved when we reached Cincinnati, Ohio, the bus driver or me. And we go out to Mother's neighborhood. She lived in one of those very exclusive apartment complexes that don't allow children. And we go out there, and there's no elevator in the building. And so I go up the stairs to knock on Mother's door, and she didn't even know I was pregnant again. And she liked to die when she opened the door. My mother was only 12 years older than my husband, and she hated my Bill. She hated him with a purple passion. After he got an A, she thought she hatched him. But she opened the door, and I said, Mother, would you please go downstairs and help Bill up the stairs? And she said, and what is the matter with Bill? Is he drunk? And I said, no, ma'am, his leg's broken. So she went down and helped Bill up the stairs and set us down on the couch for one of those talks that you all know about. And she looked at me, and she said, of all my children, Arbus, there's no doubt in my mind that you're the most brilliant child I have, but it takes a damn genius to get in a shape like this. And because of the volunteer work that my mother did, she was able to get a bed for me in a Salvation Army hospital on the charity ward. Not a room, a bed. And I don't know if my friends down in Texas appreciate this part of my story. And quite frankly, I'd like to leave it out. I'd like to forget it. But my Bill used to say I should tell you this story because it's real good for you high-bottom drunks. Our fourth child, our little Teresa, was born in a Salvation Army hospital on the charity ward. Hillbillies don't like to be obliged. And again, I saw the look of pity and disgust on the social worker's face when she wrote on my application blank in bold black letters as if I couldn't read, "Husband is a drunkard." Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. And this was not the last of the eviction notices that I was to see. And then I was to become familiar with another agency called Welfare. Hillbillies don't like to be obliged. But you'll go to a welfare agency to feed your children. You'll go to a welfare agency to get help for your young son. You'll go. And as I said, this was not the last of the eviction notices. And each one of these times I saw that look of pity and disgust on the faces of those who served them. And when I came to Texas, when I brought the children out to Texas in 1944, I had never heard the term alcoholism in reference to my young husband's drinking. Not one single time had I ever even heard the term. But I watched this boy lose everything that he had that he wanted to keep. My Bill lost his left eye in a drunken accident before I met him. And he couldn't stop drinking. My Bill lost his left arm in a drunken accident. And he could not stop drinking. I watched him lose the respect of the people he worked for. I watched him lose the love and affection of his own brothers and sisters. And finally, I saw him lose his own self-respect. And the darkest day of my life will always remain the day that my Bill was so sick, physically and spiritually, he couldn't hold a job. And he looked up at me and said, "Why don't you take the kids and leave, Arbutus? I'm no damn good." Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. And when I brought these children of ours to the state of Texas, I had never heard this term applied to Bill's drinking. But we met some people when we got to Texas. They called themselves AA members. And I never shall forget the first AA member that ever talked to me. He came to my house in the middle of the afternoon and he described to me what I referred to then as this rehabilitation program for alcoholics. I didn't know anything else to call it. And after about 2.5 hours, I said to him, "What do you have in this rehabilitation program of yours for the wives and children of alcoholics?" And he couldn't answer the question. I don't think anyone had ever asked him that before. And he said to me, "We don't have anything for the wives and children, Mrs. O'Neill. You do not have a problem." Dear God, at that moment, I couldn't wear sleeves on my arms. The doctor said that the rash on my arms was caused by nerves. I was so nervous that I couldn't stand in my own shoes. And that dear man said to me, "You do not have a problem." I thought he was wrong. I still think he was. And I believe it was that self-same cold November afternoon when I stood in the middle of a living room in a mean little rent house in Brownwood, Texas, where we wound up, where Bill grew up, that I made up my mind that someday, somehow, I would find a way to help the families of alcoholics. And by the grace of God, that opportunity came because I met some more people. Now, this was a weird bunch of people. They were non-alcoholic, but they found it vitally necessary to live by the 12 steps of the AA recovery program to preserve their stability and to restore their sanity. And I knew these people. I was drawn to them. I didn't have to have a psychologist to tell me why I needed these people. They could help me simply because they were there. And they could help me face life one day at a time. And they used to say that we didn't have a name, but we had a hodgepodge of names. Wives groups, AA auxiliaries, some that I can't repeat in polite society. But in 1951, Lois wrote a letter to all of the existing groups at that time and asked us to choose one name that we would all use, and she sent in some suggestions, and among them was the Al-Anon Family Groups, and so we became the Al-Anon Family Groups 50 years ago in May. And I've watched this fellowship evolve, as I've told you. But I couldn't trust people. I know that I believe there was a God, and I know that I tried to pray. I believe that there was a creator of the universe, if you please. I thought that he changed the seasons and turned the days into nights and hung up the stars to make it pretty for us. But I had absolutely no concept of a personal contact with God. I couldn't trust people. I couldn't even trust myself, and I certainly had no confidence in my young husband's sobriety. And that was the state of mind and being that I was in when I came here. And I tried to pray, and I know that God heard me when I could say was, "Oh, God." I think God listens very carefully for the prayers of the beginners and for the prayers of the alcoholic, because he knows that we don't have the words that prayers are made of, so he listens very, very carefully. And he heard me. I know that now. And he knew why I couldn't trust people. People do not deal very kindly with families of alcoholics. And I was not responsible for the things that I said, and I was not responsible for the things that I did. And there was an Al-Anon member in this room that will look me in the eye and tell me they never had an emotional blackout. I will suggest that you find another program. I was not responsible. Some of these people seem to have been born with an understanding heart. And the rest of these people seem to have developed that understanding because they had lived with a serious illness and sometimes with tragedy. And I knew these people. I knew these people. And back in the late 40s, they were writing some articles in the newspapers and ladies' magazines about something they called group therapy in the field of mental health. And that's what I thought these family group meetings were. And in a sense, that's what we are. So I found myself going to a little family group meeting in Abilene, Texas. There were 7 people in that group. I made number 8. At that time, I was 29 years old. And those people put my nose down in the 12 steps of AA, and I had the distinct feeling that I had to take those steps or they wouldn't let me up for air. And I took those steps for the world's worst possible motive. I was going to take those steps and slap that paper down in front of that gray-eyed sponsor's face and get an A-plus up in the corner, of course. I was going to slap it down and say, "I took these blooming steps and they didn't work." And they did. Now, I did not come here to get Bill O'Neill sober. I came here to try to find the disintegrated pieces of a personality that was once me, and somehow I'd lost it. I came here because our 4 children were afraid of me, and my husband was ashamed of me. Now, don't misunderstand me. I am not a child abuser. Our children were afraid of my disapproval. I had to watch the school play from the wings because if I sat out in the audience, they forgot their lines. They were afraid to bring home their grade card if they made a C because I would not tolerate failure. Failure had been bred out of me. I would say to them, "Anybody can be average. I expect more from you." The first thing that I noticed was that my children could relax around me. They finally got so relaxed they sashed me. "Well, don't laugh. That takes a lot of nerve." And then a little later I realized that once again Bill was proud of me. Now those of us who love alcoholics have a real sick need for approval. And the approval that we need is from the alcoholic that we love. And this is a real thing. It doesn't really take much if you'll just occasionally say to us, you did a good job. You did a good job. You look nice. Smell good. Doesn't take much. But this is a real thing for us. And I was grateful when I realized that the children could relax around me and that Bill was proud of me. And I made friends. First right in that little group down in Abilene, Texas. And then in 1960, they went off out to California for the AA International Convention. Bill and I didn't go because our daughter Peggy got married in July of that year. She didn't check the dates and realize it was the month of the International AA Convention. I don't think she was really thinking about the convention. But we didn't go because when you have three daughters, you don't miss a chance to marry them off. But they came back from California and they told me about this meeting that they'd had with Bill and Lois Wilson, and that they had proposed the idea of having an Al-Anon World Service Conference. And we started getting mail in brown envelopes from New York, and usually it got thrown in the wastebasket because the people in the Al-Anon group in Abilene, Texas didn't think those Yankees knew much about Al-Anon, so they didn't bother to open the mail. But I was curious about these strange manila envelopes that were coming out of New York, so I picked up a couple of them one night after the meeting and took them home and discovered this possibility of a World Service Conference for Al-Anon. And I got really excited about it, and so I told them, you know, that the prerequisite was that we'd have to elect a group representative and go to the assembly meeting and all those things. And the first assembly meeting that was held was in Houston, Texas, which is about a 2.5-day trip from Abilene. And nobody was interested. And, you know, the closer the assembly came, the more I urged them to get a group representative. And they got pretty tired of me nagging at them. And so we had two meetings a week, Monday night and Thursday night. I lived in a 12-room house with four children. My husband had a Alco aluminum franchise for West Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona, and only came home on weekends. And my house had to pass a white glove inspection on the weekends. This was not Bill's idea. This was my idea. And Monday morning, that place looked like a herd of buffalo had gone through it, and I didn't always make the Monday night meeting. And it was one of these Monday nights that I was absent. And when I went back to the Thursday meeting, I said, we have got to elect a group representative. And they said, we've got one. And I said, fine, who is it? And they said, you. So it cost $12 to ride a bus to Houston, Texas, and they collected nickels and dimes and pennies and came up with enough money to pay the bus fare down there. And Bill decided that it was too long a bus trip for me, so he drove me to Houston. And when I came home from Houston, I was a delegate for Texas. And we didn't have one. I didn't have one home group. There were two of them. Because there was people in my home group that felt I should not have been elected delegate for Texas because I'm not a Texan. So I went off to New York, and I met Lois Wilson, and I met Bill, and I met 11 other people who were delegates. And that's how it all started. After my panel, I left the World Service Conference pretty misty. We'd grown too large to have observers, and I knew I could never go to an assembly or to a conference anymore. I was 10 years in the program when I was elected delegate. When I was 20 years in the program, which was 7 years after I left the conference, I went back to the conference to serve on your board of trustees. I wanted to be on that board for one special reason. I wanted us to adopt the 12 concept of service while Bill Wilson was still alive. You know, he set up our conference, the structure of our conference, just like he did the AA's. He corrected a mistake he felt he made, but the AA delegates, because you all just serve 2 years. And we serve 3. Because the first year you go to conference, you don't know what to do. And by the time the AA's people find out what to do, they rotate. And we seem to do our best work with our third year. And so we serve 3 years. But I was there when Bill Wilson addressed the First World Service Conference. And if you look in your hardback book, you will find a contribution that I was able to make to our literature. Because when I came home from the conference, the people in Texas wanted to know, what does Bill Wilson think about this? And so I called the World Service Office and asked them to send me a tape of what we call Bill's talk. They regretted to tell me that there had been a malfunction in the recorder and there was no tape. But the secretary sent me the manuscript of what you will find in your book as Bill's talk. At first it was in a little pamphlet form. And when Texas wanted to know what does Bill think about this, my Bill sponsored a man that was the executive director of one of the NCA offices, and so I went by his office one afternoon. He had a mimeographing machine, and I picked up a ream of paper and went over and made 500 copies of Bill's talk. And before I went back to my second conference, I had distributed 2,000 copies of that. That's what people wanted to know. What does Bill Wilson think about this? And then later they incorporated into our book, Al-Anon Family Groups. And I was able to accomplish that. And I was grateful that we did unanimously approve of the 12 concepts of service, same as UAAs do. And those things, as I said earlier, I have watched this evolution of this fellowship, and it's been the most exciting thing in our life. My Bill wore out 2 automobiles. That was one of the problems with me being delegate, because I cannot drive a car. I can't get a license to drive a car because I'm very dyslexic, and my dyslexia is directional. And the highway department explains that an automobile weighs about 4 tons, and you don't turn left when you're supposed to go right. Anyway, I can't get a license. But through the years, and again I repeat, I could not have done the things that I've done for this fellowship had it not been for my Bill. Bill supported everything that I ever did. And people used to ask me if Bill minded me wandering around over the country by myself, and I said no, because Bill knew that you all would take care of me. And through the years, you have done that most beautifully. I have no problem with coming to clear across the country, because sometimes I get the feeling when the weekend is over that if I ask them to, the AA people would carry me to the airport on their shoulders, and the Al-Anon people won't speak to me. That's when I give them problems. But I so appreciate you having me this weekend. Last Thursday was Luther's 54th birthday, and it was a bad day for me. And these men of mine were so important in my life. And sometimes I do pretty well with adjusting to their absence. And some days I don't do very well at all. And Thursday was one of those days. And I talked to Sarah Jane that day. And I felt better for it. But I'm real pleased with the way that you all conduct yourself in this fellowship. I'm pleased that you had the good attendance that you did, and I am most grateful for your very careful attention to me. I appreciate you so very much. And I'll say the same thing to you that I say to any audience that I ever talk to. The principles of our program carries a message that the whole world needs to know. And you are the people most uniquely qualified to carry this message. If you fail to carry this message, I strongly suspect that perhaps in a stone's throw of this hotel, certainly in this town, and in any town or village that I know, Broadwood, Texas. They're drunken men and women who will never know they're alcoholic. And they'll die if you fail to carry this message. And there's men and women who do not have the courage to face life one more day living with an alcoholic. And they'll break up their homes if you fail to carry this message. And kids all over the world who never heard of Alateen. And these kids will grow up with deformed personalities if you fail to carry this message. And if you fail to carry this message, may God have mercy on those people. And may God have mercy on us.